Well, good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation in this our 18th season of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, Haiwan Wan, absent in China, and our facility specialist, Daniel Peach, here taking pictures. Katie Reuter and Chris DeMail designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of Bowling Green, Kentucky, where her family has lived for her entire life. She attended Cumberland Trace Elementary and Warren Central High School, and growing up, she wanted to be a geneticist or a biomedical researcher in cancer, and was influenced by Dr. Julia Roberts and the SCATS program and a class she took one summer in genetics. At WKU, she majored in recombinant genetics, and after her BS, she attended graduate school at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis, from where she received a PhD in biochemistry. She followed this with the National Institutes of Health postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Colorado. She joined the faculty at WKU in the biology department in 2003, where she teaches advanced cell biology, the molecular basis of cancer, and medicine in Kenya. Her interest in Kenya began in 2006, and she made her first trip there that year and has returned on 10 different occasions. Her current grant-funded research involves the study of molecular and genetic mechanisms that lead to a high prevalence of hypertension in rural Kenya. She's been involved with Partners in Caring, Medicine in Kenya, since 2008, when she developed it as a medical service learning study abroad program for WKU's pre-health students. In 2013, she received Ogden College's and WKU Faculty Award for Public Service. And in 2014, she received Ogden College's first Women in Science and Engineering Award. This past year, she received the Ogden Faculty Award for Excellence in Teaching. She'll be heading the International Year of Kenya for WKU in 2020. And when not teaching, researching, or traveling, she enjoys spending time with her family, her daughter Abby and son Jack, age 9, playing handbills in her church choir, and her backyard chickens. Her topic for tonight is the magic, mystery, and misfortune of modern Kenya. Please welcome Nancy Rice. Nancy.
Thank you very much. This is a real honor to be able to hear and to be here and talk about my favorite topic. I was talking to a student today, and I said I couldn't meet with you. I really needed to work on this, but they've only given me 45 minutes to talk about my favorite subject, and I'm not sure how I'm gonna do that. Before I begin, I'd like to thank a few people first, because I'll probably forget that at the end. Many of the photographs that you're going to see in this, what I hope will be a discussion, were photographed by Dr. Suzanne Payne and a WKU photojournalism student, Jennifer King. So I want to give them credit for that. And then I'd also like to thank WKU for supporting all of our initiatives and work in Kenya as well. That's a lot. So I wasn't really sure how to approach this discussion tonight. That's great. Can everybody still hear me fine? So I thought instead of boring you with what I do in Kenya, I would kind of give you a little overview of the country itself and what makes Kenya what, from my perspective, what makes Kenya what it is today. I do want to say that the way I've kind of organized this is looking at Kenya as a nation, and what you really may or may not get from our discussion is Kenya as people. Excuse me. And you have to remember while Kenya is a developing country, which now we say low and middle income country, the people have much, much to teach us, and perhaps at the end of the day, we have lost more than we've gained through advancement. They're relational. They live in the present. They are community driven, and they care for each other. And so I think when my students are over there, they come away with that perception more than anything, is that to be a Kenyan is to be a very happy person who's very content and really loves life. But the way I've kind of organized tonight, and this is a picture of the region where I go to Kenya, which is in southern Kenya, is just to give you kind of a little perspective from my personal perspective of what Kenya as a nation is and kind of how it came to be what it is today. And it's a very complex nation of tremendous paradoxes or differences. So I've kind of organized this in three ways. So look at the unique history of Kenya. There's no way you can understand the people and the things that happen in Kenya without understanding the history and how it became who and what it is as a nation. And then we'll look at the resources/challenges. And actually what you'll see is that most of the resources that they have end up being their challenges as well, and vice versa. And it's all very cyclical. So a lot of what drives the Kenya as a nation that we see today is factors from their history and their political system that lead to tremendous poverty, which leads to poor health, which leads to deforestation and lots of things. So it's a very cyclical process. And then, of course, I have to plug our program, our Partners in Caring program at the end. So that's kind of where we're going. What I'd also really like to hope is what I ask of my students, too, is that tonight be a discussion. So anytime I'm talking and you have a question, interrupt me. You don't have to raise your hand, obviously. Interrupt. Let this be a dialogue and a discussion about a country, and maybe learn from each other that way. When you think about Kenya, I'm not sure where everyone is on their baseline knowledge of the country. Kenya is a model developing nation in East Africa. And she told me where the pointer was. Nope.
Middle.
Thank you. It lies right here. The equator runs through it. And sort of a grassroots effort, if you will, for me is to talk about nations in Kenya by their nation name. So this is Kenya, and it's part of a tremendous continent called Africa. A lot of people talk about, well, I've never been to Africa. I want to go to Africa. You should always follow that up with, well, what country? Because all of these countries are very different with regard to culture, tradition, people groups. And so Kenya is one of what's considered a part of the East Africa region. It's also the largest and most advanced economy of East Africa, although based on U.S. standards, you would consider it impoverished. So the majority of the people in Kenya live in the rural areas as subsistence farmers, growing their own crops, and living on approximately a dollar a day. And when we say that, and I talk to my students about that, you have to remember a dollar does buy a good bit in Kenya as well. But regardless, they're impoverished. Yeah, Sam.
Oh, I just wanted to know, do you use a meridian line to determine if it's in East Africa? Like, what part of the continent is in East Africa? Or is it just a cultural line?
I think it's cultural. It's based on political alliances. And so there's an East African union of governments. And they're part of that. One of the primary problems that they suffer from is a tremendous amount of HIV, AIDS. 1.2 million people are living there. But just or living with HIV infection there. However, just like here in the States, that is also becoming a chronic disease. And we'll see that as that is being overcome, they're tending to get diseases, chronic diseases like that we see in the Western world. So they're not as susceptible to the acute infections and dying of HIV. But when you look at their median age, it's relatively low. So life expectancy is around 48 to 50. But that's a bit skewed because of HIV infection. Unemployment rate's very high. So that's the country that we're talking about. So the first thing I want to talk about is, I think, to understand Kenya as a nation, its people, you have to understand its history. And it's a very rich and diverse history. And the boundaries of Kenya are drawn really randomly based on government and political situations. So, and as a result, that incorporates a lot of different people groups. And that brings up a lot of the issues that we see in modern Kenya. So historically, Kenya is known as the birthplace of humanity, and some of the oldest fossils of hominins have been found in the Turkana Hills in the northern part of Kenya, as well as over in Ethiopia, over millions of years old. And so this is where the original ancestry of Homo sapiens began. So that in of itself is a very interesting biological, anthropological point about Kenya. The people that inhabit Kenya came from various places throughout Africa. So the first people to settle in Kenya that we know about were tribes of the what are called Cushitic from Ethiopia. These were your hunter-gatherer types. And then you also had about 1,000 years later, about 1,000 BC, you had tribes coming that were Nilotic from the Nile, from northern Africa. These ended up, you might know as the Maasai-type tribes. These are your pastoralists that graze, herd animals. And then from West Africa, you had your agrarian farmers that moved in, and these were the Bantu tribes. And so all of these different tribes lived together over many centuries and existed not necessarily peacefully, but became the current tribal ethnic alliances or the ethnicities of modern Kenya. So the majority of the Kenyans are of the Bantu, the Kikuyus, and then the Cushitic tribes, the Luos, are over here toward West Africa. And we'll see that when we talk about modern Kenya and the reason there can be so much conflict in modern Kenya, it all comes back to these tribal relationships and tribal identity. Because while Kenyans say, well, I'm Kenyan first, this tribal identity bubbles under the surface. It's very much similar to being a Texan or being from the South or being from the Midwest. You have that sort of cultural identity, and these cultural identities still are very, very prevalent. They have their own tribal language that they speak, and people identify with their original tribes. Also, the economic and political power of these tribes has typically been separate. So the Kikuyu tribes tend to hold all the modern political power, where the Luos have been trying to get some of that. The Kikuyus and these Bantu-type tribes, they've settled in the central part of Kenya. These are the very rich, fertile grounds, and so they're around Mount Kenya. The Luos are over here around Lake Victoria, and so they grew up fishing. And Obama's father was a Luo, And then the Maasai, the pastoralists, are here in the Rift Valley. And so these cultural identities still exist. The Maasai are the only tribe that still hold to their original cultural ways. Everyone else has westernized, but you will see Maasai. This is actually from a picture we took walking with them through the bush one day.
Nancy, is their political behavior, does it tend to fall along the lines of their ethnic groups?
Absolutely. And so even after the most recent election, we were over there in January, and I was talking to a friend, and I said, why don't people vote issues? Nobody votes issues. At the end of the day, people will say, well, this is a problem with the government, this is a problem, this is a problem. But when they go to the polls, they vote tribal lines. So you've got all of that tribal. There's over four, and there's actually over 40 different tribes that exist in Kenya. But the Kikuyus, the Luos, and some of the others hold, Kalenjins hold the majority. In addition, you've got a very interesting culture that exists on the coast based on the history. So Muslims from the Arab Peninsula early on, Persians, came to the coast and began trading along the coastal area of Kenya. And this trade was basically in slaves and ivory, and the Arabs began to intermarry with the native Africans along the coastal areas, and from that grew the Swahili culture, which is also very different from the inland. And so the inland is based because of missionary crusades and things are primarily Christian or still tribal. The Mombasa coast and the east coast is very much a Muslim Arabic center. And so that brings up yet another dichotomy of the culture. And you can actually see that architecturally, if you go to Mombasa, and you can see it that just on the streets, that you have a very tremendous Arabic influence in Mombasa that you don't necessarily have inland in Kenya. You can also still find lots of remains from the slave trade. These were slaves that were sent to the Arab Peninsula in Asia, so African Americans are of West African descent. These East African slaves were the ones that were enslaved in toward the east. So you have all of these different cultures. You've got this Arabic influence. You've got all these different tribes, and then historically, after, and I should say I'm jumping a tremendous amount of time here, historical time. You also had Portuguese invaders. You had an Omani dynasty from Persia that stayed there for many, many years on the coast. But very few of the traders ventured inland until the British came. And the British established what you guys know as the East African Protectorate. And from that, I think we really saw the development of Kenya as the nation that we see now. And so this is the years of British colonialism. Yeah, yeah.
Was it just that steam power allowed them to go further to the continent, or were they looking for something particular?
I think they were looking to explore.
I didn't think they ever went that far.
No, they weren't traders. They were more exploratory, and they were interested in moving inland. And many of them were actually hunters, game hunters.
So can you tell us what year that kind of
meant? Yeah, so the British Protectorate was like the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s, and then it became an actual, it was colonized in early 1900s. And so this is where you when you think of Kenya sort of in literature and movies, this is the era that quite often is portrayed. Out of Africa, those types of stories, Lord Delamere. And it really began with the British investing in building the Ugandan Railway. So this was the railway that was built from Mombasa all the way through Kenya to Uganda, and They negotiated a trade with the Maasai, moved them off their lands, and built this this railway for trade in Kenya. You might be familiar with the story, the movie, The Ghost in the Darkness, about the lions, the man-eaters of Tsavo. These are the actual lions from Tsavo. They're actually in the Natural History Museum in Chicago that were attacking the people that were building the railway during that time. Following the completion of the railway, that is really when British occupancy took over. So the British that were there moved to Nairobi. They established a government in Nairobi, and Kenya became a colony of Britain. And Lord Delamere led that. And this is when the tensions began to build, although I'm sure there were tensions before, but the real tensions began to build. You began to see Kenyan nationalism coming into play. The Kikuyus had been pushed off the fertile land in the central Kenya. The Maasai had been pushed off their land. The British were offering any European white settlers free land to bring in, to build plantations, to plant coffee and other things. And so the Kenyans were getting upset. And this is when, this is really what led to the current state of affairs, where you had the Mau Mau uprising. The leader of that was Jomo Kenyatta. And what's interesting is there were some Kikuyus who killed some livestock of a British expatriate, and in retaliation, so there were very few British that were killed in this uprising, and thousands of Kenyans died in this uprising. But the Mau Mau is really what led to independence for Kenya. And so in 1963, Britain pulled out. They negotiated a treaty with Kenya, and Kenya became independent in 1963. And the very first president of Kenya was Jomo Kenyatta here, who led that uprising. Jomo Kenyatta was a Kikuyu, and in 25 years post-independence, there were only two presidents that were in power. Jomo Kenyatta was president for 15 years, and he was succeeded by his vice president, President Moi. So you had a single-party system, and these years were rampant with corruption, with nepotism, all sorts of things. So after President Moi, we had Kibaki, who was elected president. He was also a Kikuyu. And after Kibaki, you might remember in 2007, there was a tremendous amount of ethnic violence that happened after the election, and people were killing each other along tribal lines. Well, that's because at the center of this last 50 years has been the Luo tribe. And the Luo tribe has been represented by Raila Odinga and his father, who have never been, who have run consistently for president and never been voted in. And in 2007, the polls showed at midnight that he was ahead. And then when everyone woke up, Kibaki had won. And the people revolted. I mean, it was just a national crisis. It was civil unrest, and Luos were killing Kikuyus. Kikuyus were frightened, and it was very, very devastating. And that's what led to Kofi Annan at that time. The UN ambassador went in to broker a deal, and they brokered a deal in 2007. While everyone believed that Kibaki rigged the election, they brokered a deal where he would be president and Odinga would be prime minister. And they would come up with a new constitution to put into place election policy that would prevent something like this from happening again. Well, then we had the next election, and that worked out well. The president right now is Kenyatta, and this Kenyatta, Uhuru, is the son of Jomo Kenyatta. So you can see a lot of nepotism here, and you can see why other tribes feel disenfranchised. They haven't had a voice, they haven't had a say, and regardless of who they vote for, their candidate never wins, even if the polls show that they've got the most votes. And that led us to this year, actually. Uhuru Kenyatta was up for re-election against Raila Odinga, yet again, as the opposition party, and he was up in the polls, and Kenyatta won. But what we saw this time was that the Supreme Court actually ruled that election null and void. And they had another election. And crazy politics of Kenya is part of what creates their identity as a nation. Raila Odinga pulled out. And so by default, Kenyatta is now the president. So there's a lot of turmoil that bubbles under the surface with regard to this tribal identity. That the Kikuyus have all the power, they have all the wealth, they have all the money, and while I'm Kenyan first, I'm still going to have this identity that really drives my decision making.
How is it that the Kikuyus landed on in that position of power? Did they have a close affiliation with the British when they?
So as the British left, so the British had pushed them off the highlands in the center of Kenya. As they left, and because Jomo Kenyatta was leading the rebellion, they established that relationship came out of that. And so the British were appointing many Kikuyus into positions in politics and the transition government. Okay, so that's kind of, yeah.
Sorry, go on. The way I understand it is that these gentlemen there represent two of the tribes, right? At the beginning, when you showed us this ethnic mm-hmm. structure of Kenya and also with the coast and the one in the Victoria, Lake mm-hmm. Victoria, and also on the there were more than two, right?
Yes.
How comes that just these two are the
Because based on population, they're 85% of the population of Kenya.
Okay, so that means the third ethnic group would be not allowed or not?
Well, no, there are. And actually, the collegians, and so they align themselves with one or the other. So some of the more populous tribes align themselves with the Kikuyus, and some align themselves with the Luos. So that kind of brings us up to modern Kenya, and I think you have to understand that. Somebody needs to watch my, because I could just talk. Awesome. You can't think about modern Kenya and what it is today without understanding how it got here and all of the diversity that it has, both culturally and historically, which is both a blessing and a curse for them as a nation. When I'm there with my students, we draw, as you can begin to see, we draw many analogies with the United States because of the melting pot idea. So modern Kenya, I would say, has, as I mentioned back at the beginning, has both resources and challenges that really make it what it is today. And as I said, a lot of these are one and the same. One of the biggest resources that Kenya has as a country is its extreme biodiversity. And it's home to some of the most globally, as I say, there's significant biodiversity. There's regions in Kenya that are listed as biodiversity hotspots. There's very few of these that exist over the globe, and Kenya has those, which means there are endemic species there that only exist there in the world and nowhere else. And so the idea is we need to protect these species. And when you think of Kenya, when you think of countries in Africa, these are the images that you envision, right? The large animals, the elephants, the giraffes, rhinos, the big cats, the lions, the cheetahs, the leopards, all of these. There's also a tremendous amount of biodiversity with regard to their birds and their plant species. So it's a beautiful, beautiful country as far as biodiversity, which leads to its primary economic ability in tourism.
Oh, and was it mainly just the Sahara and Africa above it that restricted the population growth of these organisms? Because, what was the, most important natural barrier to stopping them from expanding?
I don't know. Sahara and Africa, the sub-Saharan desert makes perfect sense. I'm a molecular biologist, biochemist, and I'm throwing these pretty animal pictures in there because that's what people want to see when they think of Kenya. But I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but it's an excellent question. So adaptation and limited resources and things like that probably prevented them from moving north. Also, the biodiversity is, as I mentioned, is not just the big animals that you think of, but it's their coast. So there's many national parks in Kenya. That's also a remnant of the British being there. The marine parks. I've never seen as many beautiful colored starfish in one place. You almost thought they weren't real. And so this biodiversity is there really their bread and butter if they use it to their advantage. However, it's also being threatened by them. And forgot about this. In addition to biological biodiversity, which is tremendous, they also have a unique geological diversity that many countries don't have. You have forests. You have rainforests in Kenya. You have the coastal area and all of the tropics that come around Mombasa. And you have the highlands and the Rift Valley shown here. This is the Rift Valley where the Serengeti is, and when you think of the migrations of the wildebeest and all of those things, that's here in this Rift Valley. This is a very cool, lush area, high elevation. You go from there to up north in Kenya, and you've got the desert, you've got the arid places near Sudan and Ethiopia, and then you go all the way to the coast and the coastal area. So you have this tremendous geological diversity as well. And Lake Victoria on the west is the largest freshwater lake in Africa. So it's a very rich country, full of opportunity for ecotourism and conservation. But because of, I would say, the history and the politics, this beautiful country is being threatened by by them themselves through deforestation, through poaching, through lack of environmental education, and through human-wildlife conflict. So deforestation is happening rapidly in Kenya. People are clearing the forest for charcoal. The majority of people use burned wood for heating and cooking, and they cook on charcoal, and so they clear the forest for that. There's also a tremendous amount of population growth, so they're living in these forests and clearing the forest. So they don't have clean energy sources, and they're using the wood to do that, to cook with. Which also brings up pollution issues and things like that. But the reason they're doing that is because you can walk out of your house and cut down the trees and you have wood. It's because they don't have money to buy, to pay for electricity, to pay for other sources of energy. The other thing that's a threatening biodiversity tremendously in Kenya is poaching. So a large portion of Kenya is covered in national parks. And it's one of the best things that the Kenyan government does is establish and maintain their park systems. And but because they're so large and understaffed, and people are hungry, and poverty is rampant, people are poaching wild bushmeat for food. And every day, Kenyan Wildlife Services will go out and will find snares, these traps that have been set for various types of animals. Usually, if it's for food, things like that, it's going to be your smaller antelopes. But if it's for larger game types of things, that you can, there are snares that they'll set for elephants as well. And then, of course, I didn't put any gruesome pictures in because I hardly can stand them myself. But the elephant population is declining rapidly due to poaching for ivory. And it's still, even though the ivory trade is banned internationally, it is still a tremendous, tremendous problem. Thousands of elephants every year still in Kenya and Tanzania are being killed simply for their ivory tusks, to the point where many, in some countries, I know in South Africa they're doing this, they're going in and cutting the tusks and cutting the rhino horns or painting them or disfiguring them some way so that the animal can remain. And that the poachers won't kill them for their tusks. And if you don't think it's a prevalent problem, this was dated 2017 in March, a CNN story. This was the largest bull elephant in the Amboseli National Park, who had been killed for his tusks. And he was considered a tusker bull, which means his tusks touched all the way to the ground. Elephants are, I'm kind of sidetracking here, but elephants are very much like people. They live in matriarchal groups, and they'll live for 70 years or so. And they bond with each other. They bond with their babies. And when elephants, particularly females, obviously are poached like this, that orphans the younger elephants, and quite often they die as a result. And so you get, not only do you kill the elephant for the poaching, but you're killing the young as well. And so it's not a sustainable thing. Part of the reason I think that so many of these things are prevalent in Kenya has to do with, I think, the two drivers of the nation right now, and in a negative sense, is corruption and poverty, and they feed off of each other. So corruption is leading to poaching. There's a lot of eyes that are turned. There's a lot of bribery that goes on, even today. Even though the government tries to crack down, this is outside. This is outside of the University of Nairobi, to let everybody know that the university is a corruption-free zone, which we found a little bit comical. But the corruption's at all levels, and one of the most corrupt entities in Kenya is the police. The Kenyan police is a national organization. It's not community-driven. And they're very underpaid, and as a result, it's culture that they accept bribes and demand bribes to get through traffic stops, through anything. And in particular, on the the border with Somalia, the police that are there, there's a lot of information linking the police to the infiltration of Somali insurgents across the border through paying of bribes. And so this corruption is rampant and it occurs at all levels. I had a friend just yesterday tell me that they're trying to get passports to travel, and they actually had to pay a bribe to get their passport in addition to the fee. So it's at the community level, it's at the national level. In addition to corruption is poverty, and corruption leads to poverty because corruption ends up ultimately dividing the haves and the have-nots. And the majority of Kenyans are the have-nots. And so while you have all this beautiful diversity of the country, the landscape, the animals, the geography, the most of what you see is an impoverished nation who are scraping by because the government that they have in place isn't worried about them or cared about their issues.
Are there places that you can go and hunt animals legally?
No.
Because I have a friend that
has. Not in Kenya. Game hunting is illegal in Kenya. South Africa, though, still let large game hunting happen.
But you can't hunt there. So there's different areas that have different regulations.
Different countries, yeah. Yeah. So these are just some, these are just pictures from our most recent trip. These are children at a Saturday after school program, and they're having their lunch, and this is the only meal that they would get. They're enrolled in this after school program in the communities where we go. And, you know, as a mother, I would be thrilled that my child can eat on the weekend. But as an American mother, I look and I think, okay, they're sitting on the ground, they're covered in dirt, and they've got their bowl of rice, and they haven't washed their hands, and they haven't hand sanitized. And this is a typical commerce area in a typical village. This is a seamstress shop. And this is a house that one of our local attorneys built for this family, and this is the upgrade. This is the upgraded house for them. This is a widowed mother who had five children and was living in virtually nothing. So out in the rural areas, the level of poverty is very high. And I think what happens is most of the people with wealth and money live in Nairobi or Mombasa and never go to these places. This is a slum in Mombasa, where we have a friend who runs a school. And what I also would like you to see, though, is that kind of the way I started this talk is that people in Kenya are happy. They love their life. They love what they have. And all of these children are running up here to meet us with giant smiles on their faces. I think I already mentioned this. Corruption and poverty lead to some of the things that you see in Western media about Kenya. Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group from Somalia, is really a product of poverty that exists in East Africa. The unemployment rate is 40 to 50%. In Kenya, even higher in Somalia. So you've got lots of young people with lots of time on their hands being radicalized and being paid large sums of money to join these terrorist groups. And then you couple that with corruption along the border, paying off of various police to get across the border, and you can see how they can get into Kenya. The other thing is most of these groups in Somalia are being financed by the poaching of ivory. And so there's people that they have contacts with that live near the national parks that will go in and kill the elephants because they don't have any food, they don't have anything to support their family. Ivory Tusk will bring a lot of money. These people will pay the money, and then that's what finances their, and then the Al-Shabaab will sell that to an Asian country for even more, and that's what finances this. So I don't want to leave you with, we have just a few minutes, and I don't want to leave you with a sort of a Debbie Downer approach. But that's kind of what the nation of Kenya, what you see today. And but there's a lot of things that are happening that are improving that situation. And I think there's really three main things that can help Kenya as a nation. And one of them is education, and they're doing this right. A couple decades ago, they made education free, primary education, up to an eighth grade level, free for all Kenyans, anybody who wanted to go. That doesn't mean that everyone can still afford it, because they're required to pay certain fees and they're required to buy uniforms and things like that. But it's a step forward. High school and beyond is requires tuition and support. But that's a start. They recognize that education is important in the next generation. Literacy is important. And they do value that. That is any mother's concern when she comes to talk to my group or anyone else, is, can you help me get my child in school? They want their children in school. They want their children educated. The other thing I think that is a place that is improving but obviously needs a whole lot more work is in health. Health is another driver of poverty. When you can't work, you can't earn money because you're sick, then the cycle of poverty continues. And so they are making strides with regard to improving the health of the people. But what you can see here, so this is how much they spend per capita on health expenditures, and they're the blue line here. So it's less than $50 a person per capita here. If you pull this is from the World Health Organization. If you pull this same demographic for the United States, anybody want to venture a guess what the number is?
In the thousands.
8,000. Yeah. 8,000 per capita. So there's a lot that needs to be invested in the health infrastructure. They're also making strides at mortality and morbidity for infants and mothers. AIDS deaths from morbidity from HIV/AIDS is going down. The government has instituted free antiretrovirals for individuals that have HIV, which is helping this number decrease. If you look at the United States on these numbers, under 5 mortality, how many children per 1,000 die under 5 in the United States? 7. So 10 times. Maternal mortality, we don't even think about that. Women are dying still in childbirth dramatically in Kenya. And most of this has to do with lack of infrastructure, lack of doctors in the rural areas, lack of trained people, and lack of supplies to help prevent hemorrhaging and things like that post-childbirth. So health is a place that still needs work, but where they're making some strides. And what we are seeing is that they do a very, very good job of immunizations, and that acute diseases are going down. One of the biggest problems, though, is still malaria. And malaria is actually on the rise because of deforestation. You're losing the canopies, and you're getting an increase in temperature, which allows the mosquitoes to breed even longer. And so you're seeing increases in malaria in these countries that are prone to cut down and their forests. And I put this up there because I thought this was very interesting too. If you think about Kenya and their health, and what's causing them to die ultimately. What you can see here, if you just look at color, darks, dark blue, royal blue, light blue, these are all acute types of things. These are infections. These are things that we have antibiotics for or we can prevent. That's still the majority of the reason people die. Although you can see over time that these, from 2000 to 12, the chronic types of things that we think of, cancer, heart disease, are increasing. But compare that to the United States, we're pink and purples. We're all heart disease and cancer. We've got the acute stuff under control. And this is called an epidemiological transition, and we're seeing actually Kenya in that, where these are lowering, these acute infections. HIV is kind of under control. And so now they're westernizing, and they're getting our problems on top of what they've already got. Oh, I threw this in here just to talk about corruption. So there's a non-government entity called Transparency International. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but they have a scale where they rate different countries based on their corruption and human rights and things like that. Well, Kenya ranks at 143 out of 180. We're 16. Europe, Canada, they're the best. But so the corruption, this was a 2017 scale. So it's still very, very prevalent. Okay, the very last thing, and I know I'm out of time. You told me to leave room for questions, but I want to plug our work. So the reason I came about to work in Kenya, to understand a little bit, I think, about the people of Kenya, which is very, very relevant to us here in Bowling Green, because we have so many Swahili-speaking refugees and immigrants coming into in East African immigrants coming into Bowling Green is through WKU and a program that we started to kind of do our part to help both students at an age where they're beginning to make decisions about their life and their place in the world and what they're going to contribute to the world as they grow. And so we developed this Partners in Caring Medicine in Kenya program. And so WKU is partnering with the Kenyans and helping improve the life of a small community, but we're doing our part in the health sector. And so we take students, WKU sends students every year along with physicians from this area, from the Bowling Green area, Warren County, I guess, demographic, to Kenya to partner with the practitioners there and provide medical services that they may not have. And so we've had close to 100 WKU students that have gone, and many of them are from Bowling Green. We've had Bowling Green physicians who have gone, and it's kind of our way to both assist in improving the healthcare of this community, but also influence students at a time prior to medical school or dental school or physician assistant or whatever they're going to become, to recognize that they're a global citizen and what is the state of the world outside of Kentucky, outside of the United States. In addition, you may actually even own a basket. We have a program with a local community to also increase the economy of this area by purchasing baskets from the women. They make these beautiful, they weave these beautiful baskets out of sisal, which is the plant behind you. And we sell those, and we help them find markets for those and give the proceeds back to that community to increase the economic stability of these women, many of whom are widowed because of HIV, and hopefully, ultimately, maybe in that cycle of poverty for them. So anyway, that was all I had to say. I'd love to answer questions or talk more. I didn't. I'm actually more biomedical and stuff, and I kind of got excited there at the end and about those data. I didn't want to bore you senseless, but.
community. How are they engaging and investing in Kenya? Because presumably the task of addressing the severe poverty, the poaching is maybe too great for a government rife with corruption. So are there international communities that are like the United States through your program, but like governmental, non-governmental, and how are they investing?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of non-governmental organizations in Kenya working on conservation efforts. Huge number of them. I can't even begin to list all of them, but they have anti-poaching programs. They have, and I didn't go into the human-wildlife conflict. So many of the people in the rural areas live within or right outside the national parks, which are home to elephants and these wildlife. And so under conditions of famine and drought, which Kenya has experienced a good bit of, they will come down into their, they're called shambas, their yards, where their fields, and they will eat their corn. Well, that's what they need to, they're subsistence farmers, that's what they need to survive. So there's a lot of conflict between the people and the wildlife. And so there's a lot of education going on to say, okay, how can we protect you and your livelihood, but not kill the elephants? And there's a lot of work going on how to remediate make barriers for that, things like that, without hurting the animals and not hurting the people. There's tons of NGOs doing that.
Can you tell us a bit about your personal research studying high blood pressure and how that goes on?
Sure. So my work is looking at the mechanisms that lead to high blood pressure, which is in this population, the population of East Africans, which is the primary risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And actually, globally, we're seeing that cardiovascular disease is the most rapid increasing disease in developing countries, because they're managing their acute infections relatively well. They're adopting Western lifestyles, Western eating habits, and so they're getting obesity, diabetes, and things like this. And so this work actually came from the community where we work. The area where we work is called Kasigao, and that first slide, it was the mountain. It's Mount Kasigao, and the villages surround that. And they actually wanted to know why they had such high levels of hypertension. And no one had ever quantified it. We kind of saw it anecdotally in our clinics. And so that's kind of how the work came about. And we've been working with them, with community people, to do both sort of public health epidemiology, looking at how much hypertension they really have, and then what are maybe some of the risk factors that they have in that community leading to that, to help educate them on ways to prevent that or to lower that. The ultimate goal is to get the government, the Ministry of Health, it's their health system is government run, to provide antihypertensives in these communities. Right now they don't. The majority of people with hypertension are unmanaged. But what's really interesting is we haven't found any of the factors that we consider as risk factor for heart disease here. Diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol, they don't have any of those. They walk miles and miles a day. They eat very little and very healthy. And so we're kind of stumped. So now we've moved into, I'm a molecular geneticist, and so we've moved into looking at various genes and presets, susceptibilities and various gene pathways that might be specific for East Africans.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that it would be a genetic evolutionary
It is, and actually it's thought that what may have been adaptive at one time in these semi-arid areas of Africa to hold on to water, because part of your hypertension is water and salt regulation, right? And so they might have particular genetic variants that allowed them to hold on to water in semi-arid environments that over time, evolutionarily, have become maladaptive and leading to hypertension. But the most recent hypothesis we're testing that I'm really excited about is the link to household air pollution. There's a lot of work showing that carbon monoxide and particulate matter in pollution can lead to heart disease dysfunction. Most people have always studied that with regard to respiratory issues. So they're constantly exposed. And so there's an initiative that's been really primarily focused on South America for clean cook stoves. And it hasn't really reached Africa yet. But there's a lot of work, well, there's some work showing that air pollution can make changes in your DNA to predispose you to hypertension. And that's kind of what we're thinking is happening here.
Other questions? Yes, back here.
I just had a class last semester with Dr. Stokes and Dr. Nadeau from the sociology department.
Oh, yeah.
It was actually called Human Wildlife Conflict. And he also works in Casigo for his studies. Do you happen to do anything with the human wildlife conflict, even though you are a molecular geneticist?
I don't. So Dr. Stokes and Dr. Day are good friends of mine. That's actually how we got started in Casigal. It was through their work in wildlife conservation. And we visited this area and talked about with the community whether or not they would want or would be interested in partnering with us in different community initiatives. They already had the conservation efforts going, and would you be interested in sort of a health initiative? And so we kind of think of our work in Casigal as a larger community development work, because now we also have people that are affiliated through blood, I guess, through family, that working with the schools. There's educational opportunities there. And so it's really a community development initiative in Casigal, but I don't do any wildlife stuff. I look at them and I think they're really pretty.
Well, if there are no other questions, I want to especially thank you.
Oh, thank you.